For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. Along with me in the cave, Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Guys, everybody by now has probably seen The Matrix and its sequels. Could it be reality? Is there any possibility that something of a controlled nature like The Matrix could ever really exist?
Well, you know, there was some research done by a team in California recently where they were able to come closer, I guess, to uploading knowledge directly into the brains of some of the subjects they were using in an experiment that seems very Matrix-like. So what happened here was they worked with a group of pilots, and they kind of mapped where the brain was being stimulated while they were using a simulator. And then they took 33 novices, and with those novices, they were able to sort of stimulate similar areas of the brain while they were in the simulator, and it improved their performance significantly. So they were able to learn how to fly a plane better by just simply having their brains stimulated in certain areas that corresponded with the expert pilots. Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, very cool and very scary, though, at the same time, right?
It brings up lots of questions. And, of course, that's what we're here in the cave to do, is to kind of look at stories like this, get a little bit behind the headlines, and look at some of the concepts, some of the ideas, to try to uncover the truth behind what sort of is out there in the appearances of the news, of the media, of the world in general as we experience it.
Well, I guess one of the things we really need to look at then is – we have certain capabilities within science that are coming more rapidly all the time. Where do we draw the line between what we can do and what we should do?
Right, because just because we can upload knowledge, and you know, this experiment, it's a far, far, you know, there's a lot of distance between being able to just suddenly upload in 5 seconds the knowledge of Kung Fu, like happened in the Matrix.
I would love that. I would love that. I'd love that old television show, you know, and I'd love to be a Kung Fu master.
Right, right.
Without putting in all the work and effort.
Exactly. So, you know, like I said,
skip all those years of training.
That scene in the Matrix where Neo learns it all in 5 seconds, you know.
Fantastic.
Now, we're still a long way away from that, but the question is, should we do that? Even if we can, even if we could upload certain knowledge like that, should we do it? Or is there value in the process of education itself?
Well, I love that question, Mark, because it gets right at the heart of ethics. And for Catholics, increasingly, we do find ourselves, as you mentioned, Kent, more and more, I feel like behind the eight ball a little bit, behind the times, because technology and its capabilities, its promises for enhancement and improvement, very alluring, very glamorous, but not always necessarily aligned with the good, right? And that gets to the heart of the matter, right? Just because we can doesn't mean we should. And so where do we draw those lines or limits?
And I think even more interesting that is, how do we go about finding those limits? How do we go about thinking about the science and thinking about what we ought to be doing to figure out, okay, how far can we really go and how far should we go?
Yeah, so today's episode, really, I think we're going to spend time looking at sort of these biotechnology issues and therefore some bioethical issues. And we're fortunate in that Holy Mother Church and Catholic scholars and institutions have been doing some very good thinking and research and dialogues. But as fast as that's happening, technology continues to push at a very rapid pace.
Right. You know, we're coming up on we mentioned this last show, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae. And I think that's a great case study to look at, because there you've got an example of technology that was brought in that
i.e. the birth control
pill. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Humanae Vitae is
the dawn of that.
Right, and Humanae Vitae was the encyclical written by Paul VI, which addressed the issue of birth control and contraception and said, you know, no, this really interferes with the nature of marriage. And not only that, it really interferes with the nature of the whole relationship between men and women. And so there'll be a whole bunch of societal fallout from embracing the birth control pill. And, well, lo and behold, 50 years later, we're seeing a whole bunch of that fallout. But I think this is a great case study to look at of how the church goes about studying a technological issue and trying to figure out how that technology is going to affect the realm of faith and morals.
Well, and I think one of the important things for us to keep in mind, too, is that technology, we often think of technology as neutral. And so, sometimes it may be neutral, but other times I think we've got to be aware that it is actually working on us and maybe even sometimes working against us.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating thing, that valuation to a certain extent of inanimate objects, which, you know, technology, you know, an iPhone's a great example of technology. So that valuing, you know, if I walk into a room and there's a thermonuclear device in front of me, I don't exactly have a neutral reaction to it. I mean,
right. especially if there's a digital clock on it, seems to be winding down.
Exactly.
Cut the red wire.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I'm suddenly no longer in The Matrix. I'm in a James Bond movie.
Right, or that M&M commercial.
But anyway, really, when you look at it, it's just red wires and clocks and metal and, you know, a thermonuclear device. But, it, you know, in its essence, it's just an inanimate object. But there's a tremendous amount of value that's brought to it based on what it can do.
Right.
And
what it might be about to do.
Right. And based on its potency. And
right.
So, you know, I think when you're trying to put that value, you've got to look at what is the potential that this object or the potential that this technology can bring about actually? And so I think that's one great way to sort of evaluate and put some valuation on the technology as you're looking at it.
Well, I want to go back to this idea of The Matrix. So in that movie, The Matrix, one of my favorite movies of all, the first one at least, from there, like many that have follow-ups to it, it did seem, at least for me, it lost some of its luster as the plot thickened through the various sequels. But in the first one, it was so captivating because here we're presented in that movie this, it would appear to be an ordinary young professional sort of grinding it out in a, you know, kind of meager existence as a lowly programmer in a kind of a sterile corporate world, and but living at night as a kind of a secret hacker, you know, for a little bit of excitement and things like that. But he's presented with, and it seems as if he's living this a complete total kind of reality, complete with friends and employment and sunshine and apartment and furnishings and all that, only to discover later on there might be something else going on behind that. That there might be another kind of reality, or rather, the really real behind what he is perceiving to be reality.
Right. Yeah, you know, The Matrix is a sort of modern retelling in a lot of ways of Plato's allegory of the cave.
It sure is.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got your prisoner that's trapped in the everyday life. He doesn't know that he's trapped, you know, kind of looking at these illusions, or in the case of The Matrix, having these illusions funneled into his head. And he's suddenly brought to an awareness of what the real reality is behind all of the illusions. And, you know, now it's his job to go and tell the universe about it and try to help the other captives, you know, turn away from this sort of illusory world that everybody exists in.
That's a fantastic way to present that, because he also goes through all these different struggles, right? That it's just like in the allegory of the cave, when he comes to the realization that he had been in sort of this operating this area of sort of mere appearances, now he's confronted with reality. And reality is stark. It can be jolting. It's not all, you know, rainbows and puppy dogs, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, in The Matrix, actually, reality is even more menacing and more threatening in a lot of ways than the reality that they were presented with, which, you know, that's sort of a significant difference from Plato's allegory, isn't it?
Yes, it is. In fact, in Plato's allegory of the cave, it's aspirational, right, that we would want to, once we come out of the cave into the realm of the divine ideas, we begin to possess knowledge and understanding and wisdom such that it does change us, but it changes in a way that we actually become concerned for others, that we want to then sort of rescue, to a certain extent, return to the cave and rescue those who are trapped there. But remember, in the allegory, those who are still in the cave sometimes put up a fight. Sometimes they don't want to be told about what's really real, right? We all experience this, right? We'd rather not have our illusions. Don't burst my bubble. You know, I'm happy in my bubble.
Yeah. Well, to bring it back a little bit towards the topic of this show, you know, the illusion in The Matrix is created by technology. And that technology, you know, you're kind of looking at a futuristic world to a certain extent, where the technology has gotten to the point where it has created this illusory world, and to a certain extent, we've become slaves to the technological world. There,
humanity has been subjugated for the purpose of the technology to feed off it.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Because humanity is trapped in these sort of cells, where the technology feeds off the energy that the body naturally produces, and therefore to pacify us, the humans, we're fed into our minds this whole dream world to keep us placated while technology feeds off us. And you know, it reminds me a little bit of my iPhone. And so
right.
I feel like sometimes my iPhone has a mind that's working, that's sort of subjugating me. And so, you know what? When we come back from this break, Mark, let's take up this whole idea of this relationship.
The Great Lakes Gabriel Project is an ever-growing Christian-based network of church volunteers standing together in their commitment to offer assistance to women and families facing difficult or unplanned pregnancies.
I'm Eileen Hartman with Great Lakes Gabriel Project. If you're interested in volunteering to help this life-affirming effort, please go to our website, goangels.org, for more information.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell. Here in the cave is my fellow cave dweller, Mark Tuttle, and our trusty companion, Kent Blandford. Hey, right before the break, Mark, we were talking about the relationship between technology and humanity. I use the terms master and slave. Let's talk a little bit about that relationship that we have as human beings, as human persons, as we're confronted with ever-increasing sophisticated technology, maybe even zeroing in a little bit on some of these breakthroughs in biotechnology. We've been using the movie Matrix as a way to kind of help us get at that.
Right, because The Matrix presents a world where technology has really taken over. And you know, very much the movie is showing a world where technology has enslaved humanity and is literally sucking the life out of people to keep itself maintained. And this is not a new idea. This idea has been around for really since the beginning of, I think, the technological industrial revolution. People have looked at what was going on and said, you know, this really does have the capability of changing the nature of human beings, changing the nature of what humanity is. And, I love that movie, The Matrix, because, yeah, it, on the one hand, it is sort of a cinematic retelling of the allegory of the cave, but it's also a cinematic embodiment of some of the philosophical ideas of Martin Heidegger. And Heidegger dealt a lot with the relationship between humanity and technology, and more importantly, the how humanity is able to change the meaning of the universe just through our technological development, how technology changes the meaning and nature of something because of what we're able to do with it. The great threat there, then, is that through our ability to manipulate nature, we're able to manipulate our own nature. and we're able to a certain extent, change the meaning of humanity. And the great threat there is we could ultimately change humanity into just yet another device to be able to keep all the other devices going. So,
right.
And, you know, I think all of us experience this at work. I mean, we seem to spend an increasing amount of time maintaining our computers, maintaining our phone systems, maintaining the technology that allows us to do all of the things that we do at work. So, you know, to a certain extent, we become more and more a slave to the technology that we've developed to help us do the things that we want to do. And we have less and less time to actually do the things that we want to do.
Well, who hasn't had the experience these days, Mark, of going out, you go out to lunch somewhere, you go out to dinner somewhere, just an ordinary, say, chain restaurant, right? I had this experience just the other day. And they're, you know, waiting for our sandwiches to be brought over. I looked around and, boy, I got to tell you, everyone was on. I mean, the place was packed. I mean, there must have been 100 people in the restaurant. And the place was packed. And I got to say, out of 100 people, 95 of them were on their phones.
Right.
And it was so common to see. And what really caught my attention was the table next was a family. And sure enough, mom, dad, and the two kids. So there's your modular family. All four of them were all sitting together, looking down at their palm of their hand where their phone was and doing something on their phone. Zero interaction. Now, maybe they were texting the person next to them, because that happens too. But right. But it just struck me as a very odd and maybe sad and perhaps portends to the way in which technology is really changing the social fabric,
right,
even at the family level.
Yeah, and technology will always do that. I think that's the nature of technological development. You know, even the development of the interstate highway. I have political debates with this about it. It wasn't all good. There's a lot of negative fallout that's come because of the development of the interstate highway. We used to have, you know, we still see the nostalgia for Route 66. All the great restaurants and Americana and all of the American heritage that went into that Route 66. And Route 66 wasn't the only, you know, transcontinental route like that where people would, you know, take and have that sort of almost mythical status. You think of Jack Kerouac's book, On the Road, and you kind of get a picture of what travel across the country was like back then, but also how interconnected all the communities were, because when people traveled, they had to drive through the towns. And so people became familiar, not just with their town, but with the next town and the next town. And so, you know, to a certain extent, yeah, the country was bigger because it took us a lot longer to get our goods and also for us to travel across the country. But we were a lot more connected because we were familiar with each other. And the interstate highway system, something completely, benign, or I think most people would see it as a good. Hey, I can get from here to Los Angeles and, you know, a couple of days rather than, you know, a couple of weeks as to what it used to take. Most people see that as a tremendous good, but there's a lot of negative and a lot of downside, some of it anticipated, some of it not anticipated. And that's just the nature of any technological development, that there's going to be sort of almost this creative destruction. I think that's what the economist Polanyi talked about. He talked about, you know, this all of development and technology is this process of creative destruction, that is, you're creating more things, you're destroying things in its wake.
Well, it also makes me think of there's a lot to that, Mark. It makes me think also of the idea of this someone coined, you know, being alone together. You know, where now we're together in ways that and connected in ways we never were before. So yeah, we're connected in ways we can get to different places faster through the highway system. Certainly, the internet has brought about, and social media, social networking, all the kind of very, very rapid transit, things like that. But at the same time, it seems as if, I'll go back to my example my experience at the restaurant the other day. Here we are, 100 of us in this restaurant, and we're not really present to the person who's sitting right next to us. And we're not really present even to the person who's sitting next to us, who might really even be the person we're closest to in the whole wide world. It might be our mom or our dad or our child. And so here we are together and yet somehow alone.
Well, that's one of those things, you know, for centuries, they've always talked about the failure of a long-distance relationship. You live in this city, she lives in that city, it's not going to work. Now we've come to the point where we could be sitting across the table from each other, and we're in a long-distance relationship.
Right, and you know, I think that's a great example of how the technology changes these things, because the technology that allowed us to be able to have those long-distance relationships, you know, a long-distance relationship before the telephone would have been almost unheard of. I mean, you could write letters back and forth, but you know, that's a letter. It's very hard to develop a relationship based on letter writing. The telephone allowed that conversation, that instantaneous conversation, to go back and forth. And then the computer and the smartphone and all of that, suddenly you had the ability to Skype. You had the ability to you know, teleconference. And so the technology increased this ability for long-distance communications, but it also made long-distance communications the preferred mode of communication. And so now you're sitting at a restaurant and you're communicating with each other as if it were a long-distance relationship, because that's what the technology was built to do. So the technology that was built to do something, we're using it in that way, and we're using it in some ways for a purpose that is, it really, that's not what it was created for. So I think that's one of the first things to look at with a technology is, okay, what is the purpose of the technology, and how can this purpose be used in ways that it's not intended to be used, that's going to disrupt and change the nature of other things?
Well, for example, when we began the program today, Mark, you shared that story about how scientists now have been able to run at least one experiment where it seems as if they were successful in implanting and influencing, taking experienced pilots' thoughts, brainwave patterns, and brain activity, and sort of influencing or sort of superimposing. I'm not sure how the technology works. Uploading, yeah, like in the Matrix, basically, to what? Rookie pilots, right? People are just learning how to become pilots and using a flight simulator, and they noticed a substantial improvement when they were using this sort of transfer almost of or transmission of experience from into someone who lacks that experience and know-how. It makes me think, though, so if we're able to do that, and you bring up purposes, so imagine we might not be too far away from the day where, let's say, you're a couple. So you could be boyfriend, girlfriend, you could be husband, wife. You happen to be separated physically by distance. It could be because one's at home, one's at work, one's traveling or out of the country, whatever. But because of smartphones, we have that sort of instant connection you're talking about. But now, let's take it a step further. Let's say your smartphone now can also be equipped with a type of extension cord that plugs in. And so you no longer simply have a spoken conversation with your spouse, let's say. It's not just an email to your spouse or texting back and forth, but you're actually then now able to, at some level, begin to share each other's thoughts. In other words, you can plug in and you're able to kind of share each other's thoughts or impressions of each other's emotions or feelings, and in a way that we can't now. And so that technology seems as if it's right around the corner based on this experiment that we've just learned about with these pilots. I mean, what might be some of the implications of that?
Well, it's some of the positives with that. You know, I can think of so many arguments and things that you have with another person where it's based on you not being able to adequately communicate what you're thinking and feeling. Maybe that's a guy problem. I don't know. And so, you know, being able to just simply push a button and download, this is what I'm thinking, this is what I'm feeling, you know, you could probably alleviate a lot of the friction, a lot of the arguments, a lot of the problems. I could see this being a great therapy tool.
In a
marriage therapy session, for instance. So, I mean, there's a lot of positive that could definitely come from this.
And I see an awful lot of negative that could come from it, too.
Right. Maybe that's a guy thing, too.
Yeah, you know, simple matter of, you know, a lot of times we censor our thoughts. We censor the things that come out of our mouths. But if we can't censor what's coming out of our head into someone else's.
Unfiltered.
Right.
Filters are a wonderful thing. And we'll take a look at exactly how we should apply those filters right after this.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just two words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then below that, in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford, along with Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. We've been talking about technology this morning, and I guess, guys, for better or worse, technology's here. It's going to continue. What do we do about it?
Well, you know, the nature of technology is change. And so the extent to which technology changes things, I think we completely underestimate. We were just talking about how technology, simple technology like the iPhone, has changed human relationships. Now you walk into a restaurant, you see people sitting around, you know, staring at their screen, not interacting with each other. And we said that's because that's what the iPhone was developed to do. It was developed to allow very efficient communication over distance, but it really wasn't intended to be able to, you know, substitute for that interaction that happens over a dinner table. And so, As the technology has changed the nature of human relationships, technology has the ability to change a tremendous amount of things. You know, we talked about the interstate highway system, how that's changed the nature of our country to a certain extent, almost as an unintended side effect. You know, maybe it should have been foreseen, but for whatever reason, it wasn't. And so the interaction and the knowledge that we used to have of the towns and the villages and the restaurants and everything that we would know from traveling, we no longer do, just simply because we're now on an interstate highway and we never stop.
Yeah, we're missing out on Radiator Springs. That's
exactly
all
there is to it. Exactly, exactly.
There you go.
So, Tim, right before the break, you had brought up an interesting thought experiment. In California, they were able to figure out that they could mimic the brain patterns of a set of pilots and greatly enhance the ability of novice pilots to perform in a simulator. So they were able to almost upload the thoughts of the pilots.
Just like the movie The Matrix.
And transplant them into another group of people, and it worked. I mean, the new pilots were, you know, 33 to 40% better than a control group that didn't have these other other thoughts transplanted into their brains. So you brought up the idea of what if this technology leads to where you could come home and you could push an app on your iPhone and you could suddenly download your thoughts and transplant them into the brains of your spouse. And, and I started,
it takes the whole honey, do you want to talk to a new level.
Right, exactly. And you know, obviously we said, you know, there's actually a very good side to this because sometimes we do have communication problems. But the downsides, I think we all kind of sit there and say, yeah, maybe the downsides of that one would outweigh any potential.
The lack
advantages
of filters and things like that. Not every thought's a good right. thought, right? I mean,
but you know, I think the upshot of that is, you know, a human relationship is built upon a process of getting to know the other person.
Disclosure,
and an unfolding of mm-hmm. the other person to you. And it's not too different than the way everything, the entire world to a certain extent, unfolds to you through your daily interactions with it. So your initial dates, your initial courtships with your future spouse, it's a process of slow and gradual revealing. And I think to a good extent, that process gets disrupted badly if that slow process is suddenly transplanted one person to the next.
Yeah.
Exactly. You lose the excitement. You lose you lose the romance to a great extent if that process of unfolding and revealing of one person to another is disrupted.
Well, I also think that there could be a loss of receptivity. So if in that relationship where one is in, you know, going, like you said, this unfolding, this disclosing, this revealing, you know, kind of bit by bit, you know, over time through this courtship or marriage, long marriage over time. But the other person also, as you're disclosing, there's also a kind of receptivity that you want from the other person. And when you do a data download, it seems to sort of, you know, circumvent that whole kind of disclosure with a kind of intentionality and deliberation that goes along with it. But also when someone's disclosing something about themselves, let's say, that's intimate, as the receiver of that, there's a kind of care and receptivity, a kind of embrace, if you will, of that person when they're doing that, right? And so a data download, to me, seems like wouldn't leave a lot of room for these uniquely human qualities.
Right. And I think it wouldn't leave a lot of room for a uniquely human relationship.
Right, right.
Because
it'd be very robotic.
Well, it'd be very robotic. But I'll even throw out that, you know, my wife is not the same person to me as she is to you.
Right.
You know, my relationship with her is very different. And to a great extent, she's an entirely different person to me than she is to somebody else.
Right.
And it's not just a spousal, you know, husband wife thing. I mean, I think this goes on in friendships. I think this goes on to a certain extent, even with inanimate objects, that our relationship with those things that's built up over experience, built up over time, changes the nature, changes the value, changes what those things are. You know, we're sitting in the studio. I'm looking across at the door. And, you know, I think the door and the door handle on that door, we use it every day. We use it to open it. We use it to close it. And we have a generally pretty positive, neutral relationship with that doorknob. Until the one day when I walked into the studio in the morning and Kent was struggling to get that door open because the doorknob had broken.
Nah.
And he was saying things that we can't repeat on the radio.
Yeah. Hope you went to confession.
Exactly. And so suddenly Ken has a different relationship with that doorknob than he had a few minutes earlier. But he also has a different relationship with that doorknob than I've ever had with that doorknob. Because
you hadn't had the same problem.
Because I've never had the same problem. I've never had that same experience. And I, to this day, Kent will never look at that doorknob the same way again. it's just true. And I've never had that experience with the doorknob. So I don't have that same relationship with the doorknob.
I never liked that doorknob in the first place.
And I mean, this is a very sort of, you know, almost silly sort of example, but, you know, I think we think about our relationship with our cars, you know, our cars to a great extent are very idiosyncratic.
Oh yeah.
You know, that's why it's been difficult, I think, for cities and Americans to embrace public transportation and other modes that may technologically be better, but we've still got our attachments to our cars because of a long history and long tradition of experiences collectively with our automobiles. So technology, when you start to change the way something's used, when you start to change the way we interact with it, you actually change the objects and you change all the objects around it. So technology has the ability, especially when it's foisted upon us, the way this sort of data upload and download that we're talking about, would have the capability of changing our relationships with things, but it would have the capability of changing the things themselves and changing the people themselves very quickly and rapidly. And that's a scary thing that I think we should be aware of.
Well, one of the limitations to something along those lines, for example, let's say we could download the skills and the mental abilities of Bruce Lee into my body. I guarantee the first time I tried a spinning back kick, I would be hospitalized. There are limitations. We might have the knowledge. Now, whether that's being used or put into a suitable container, a suitable tool for that, is another complete situation we need to look at.
Well, I you're right. Going back to the what kind of got the ball rolling today on the show, this idea of this successful experiment of uploading knowledge from experienced pilots to novice pilots and then proving it has a positive impact on them, brings up some fundamental, you know, to here in the cave, we want to get some of the fundamental assumptions. Let me lay out a couple of them. One is that we might want to be concerned about. One is that in this group, there's consent, right? That the experience, that everyone involved in this experiment consented to it. So both those who have the knowledge that was obtained from them, and then those who consented to have something uploaded to them. Another aspect we got to think about, well, what exactly is the nature of the knowledge that's being transferred? Here, it's a specific kind of skill set around flying a plane. But one might imagine, as Kent, you were talking about, there's all kinds of knowledge that maybe ought not to be shared,
right,
or spread around. And then there's also this idea of there's those, the scientists who have successfully developed this. They have a certain now kind of knowledge and skill and know-how, if you will. Well, what if instead of doing something that seems to have a positive benefit, right, of maybe upskilling pilots faster, what if instead we were this was being used by, say, a terrorist group to spread effective bomb making technology faster among, say, jihadists, you know?
Right, yeah.
And to speed along the number of, skilled bomb makers that they have, right?
Yeah, and Kent brought up, I think, even yet another consideration, and that is the friction between, I think, technological advance and natural limits. So, and that's going to be based on our knowledge to a certain extent as well. What I might technologically be able to do, I may not physically be able to do, and your case, the kung fu, but that transfers over to, knowing the nature of the materials that we're working with when we're trying to technologically do something. The technology may be able to push the limits of a particular set of materials to the breaking point, mm-hmm. And the breaking point could be unknown. I mean, we run the risk of, to a certain extent, I think, kind of breaking nature through the technology that we impose upon it.
Boy, that I want to underscore that, Mark. That is a brilliant point, because there are a lot of unknowns here, right? And this is the frontier, And so I think, for Kent, for your safety and mine too, I mean, I want to learn Kung Fu. Instead of Bruce Lee, we better look at Kung Fu Panda and figure out how to upload those moves first and then move into the Bruce Lee stuff. But this whole idea of the unknown gets us back to the heart, one of the heart of the matter, I think, which is, where do we differentiate, or how do we move from what I can do to what I ought to do? And so defining, where these, thinking about where we ought to place reasonable limits, which we hate to do. We hate to do it, Mark. We hate to place limits, because limits seem to curtail what I would say in our current cultural setting is the number one value, which is freedom. I gotta be free to be me, right, Mark? So don't put your limits, don't impose your limits on me, because I'll decide where my limits are, right? Isn't that what we're up against?
Right, and another word for limits, etymology, you look back, the word definition is really another word for limits. And I think a lot of this gets back to understanding and knowledge of nature. So I think there's a lot of sort of, and I think anybody that's worked in technology recognizes this, there's a desire to do something, but you have to put that within the reality of what science allows us to do, given the materials, given nature, given the things that we're to work with. So a lot of this has to do with that interplay of the definition of what we're working with, of what we are, of who we are, of the kinds of things that we're trying to manipulate, versus the potential and the desire. And so in some ways we're getting back to almost a scholastic framework, which as you know, in the Catholic cave, we almost always gravitate back to good old scholasticism. So we need to take another break, but when we come back from the break, we're going to try to apply some scholastic principles to these questions that are brought up by technology.
Matt Swaim here, host of the Sunrise Morning Show on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, this is Teresa Tomeo from Catholic Connection.
Hi, this is Barbara McWiggin, host of The Good Fight here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ray Guarendi, host of The Doctor Is In Here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta, and you can join me for Cresta in the Afternoon here on Catholic Radio Indy.
The best of EWTN plus great local programming. That's what you get when you support Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford. And guys, we're talking about technology today. And as we led into the break, we suddenly jumped back to the 14th century. And
Amen, brother. Yeah. I love it back there. Some of my favorites, Aquinas, Bonaventure.
You never knew the cave was a time machine.
Right. And so, yeah, here's the big question. Why this jump backwards in time, almost to a time before technology? Now, I think that's a little bit of a misnomer about the Middle Ages. There was a lot of technological advance all the way up through the Middle Ages, but that's a topic for a history.
Another show,
not this show. But laying that aside, obviously, back in the Middle Ages, they didn't have iPhones, they didn't have computers, they didn't have cars, they didn't have most of the technology that we have. And yet, they, in a lot of ways, seem better equipped to be able to deal with the technological change than we do, given the state of modern philosophy. Why is that, Tim?
Well, they have something that I think is all but lost on most of us these days, which is that they had a much better understanding of first principles, of metaphysics, of what it, of human nature, of nature in general. And today, I think it's fair to say that one of the major crises in philosophy is this pitting of science, especially the natural sciences, as sort of the master over which nature is not only subdued, but manipulated, manufactured, and even, I would say, malformed into whatever one desires. And so while we possess dazzling electronic gizmos that I certainly appreciate having many of, it's also, I think, true to say that in a large part, it's obscured our traditional insights into what it means to be authentically human.
Right. Yeah, Ken had brought up the idea of stem cell research as being a great example of this, that, you know, when you look at embryonic stem cells and you study embryonic stem cells, it's magnificent as to what they're able to do. And you come to a much, much better understanding of how the rest of the human body is made up, how the rest of the body is formed out of these fundamental, very plastic cells that can change into any type of cell in the human body. You can suddenly get a better understanding of, okay, well, how is the liver constructed based on how it came? And there's a lot of medical applications to being able to figure out, get a better map of how the body's constructed from these embryonic stem cells. But what happened? Once they were discovered, almost instantly, science moved to how to manipulate them and how to utilize them to do things, not just to understand the human body and improve medicine, but to manipulate the human body and to a certain extent, do things with the human body that the human body was never meant to do.
That's right. And you know, there's been this race to obtain stem cells, strict and really from embryonic lines, which always involve, when you harvest these stem cells from embryos, it always involves the destruction or the killing of the embryos. So right there we have an intrinsic evil and a kind of prohibition. Thank goodness other scientists opened up a technology from which we can, they're able to get stem cells from adults that doesn't involve the destruction of embryos. So it shows a way in which, just because we can do something, get embryonic stem cells in hopes of the promise that it offers, we also ought to sometimes hit the pause button and think, well, wait a minute, killing embryos is the wrong way to go about seeking cures for other more developed embryos, which we call human beings.
Because we've suddenly put a person at the service of the rest of humanity. And so we've made a slave of these people to a certain extent. Even though they're little embryos, they're still people. And so enslaving them and obviously destroying them and putting them at service of the rest of us is just intrinsically against the nature of what a human being is. And I think that's kind of the big danger of technology, is it distorts that line between the nature of what a human being is or the nature of what something else is. And it tries to put that at the service of what we want it to be or what we want it to become.
Well, I think one of the interesting things when we're dealing with stem cell research is the fact that from everything I've read, and I don't believe this has changed recently, most of the successes that have been held with stem cell research have been from adult stem cells. We really have had no true successes from a medical standpoint based on the use of embryonic stem cells.
Correct. Yeah, because the adult stem cells are a little bit more controlled. They're a little bit more controllable. And obviously, they also come from an adult human body, that when you put them back in that same adult human body, you don't have problems like rejection.
Like you
and,
would.
The body rightly recognizes this as part of itself rather than a foreign object that needs to be expelled or gotten rid of or dealt with in some way.
Well, and I think that reconfirms, you know, that we ought to continue to seek out licit means for cures rather than making emotional appeals that don't really serve us well. And I also, while we're talking about, embryos and stem cell research, it really, for me, draws to mind this idea of designer babies, right? That now what we're going to through the use of technology, we can go to certain clinics, we can go and we can order a certain kind of baby, right? We can order a baby that has the promise or likelihood to have desirable characteristics such as, you know, hair color, gender, eye color, certain kinds of ethnicity or avoiding other kinds of ethnicity, but also a certain kind of intellectual promise, right? That the stock from which the sperm and ovum have been harvested are from, you know, Ivy Leaguers or something like that, right? And so we simply then kind of pull up an electronic menu on the web, click boxes of, you know, kind of what we want, kind of not too different from ordering a sandwich online. And then, you know, you sort of place your order, you pay the money, and then you have to, you wait, and then eventually your baby can be delivered to you. It's really objectified, you know, this whole idea of, I mean, here's technology, I think, just run amok, where we've taken the most beautiful gift God gives us, which is to be shares in procreation, right? And shares in his creation by procreating. And here we have a human being with an immortal soul, and we basically turned him into like ordering a bicycle.
Right.
From Amazon.
Yeah, the technological process has changed the meaning of what the thing is. So the technological process that went into creating it has turned a baby, a human being, somebody that's created in the image and likeness of God, into a consumer product, something that you can order. Now, the same technology, on the other hand, can be used for very good things. You can use that same technology probably to help alleviate a lot of defects, a lot of health problems, a lot of health issues. You know, you think about, what if we were able to manipulate the genome to a certain extent so that hereditary diabetes mm-hmm. was out the window. I mean, there's a lot of potential, but there's some fine red lines you can't cross. Obviously, you can't destroy human beings for the sake of making better human beings down the road. That's a big fat fine red line.
Right.
And I think also you have to look at, we can't do things to change the nature of what or who a human being is. We can only work towards, I think, to a certain extent, a better actualization of the potential of what a human being could be.
Well, and I think we talked a lot last time, last episode, about marriage and the goods of marriage. And this technology, in a variety of different forms that we've talked about, either on this show or last show, whether it's the technology as it's presented to us, say, through artificial contraception, whether it's through in vitro fertilization, embryonic stem cell research, and on and on and on, various forms of human enhancement present real challenges to us as Catholics. And we ought not to just because we can doesn't mean we ought to do it.
Exactly.
So these are all areas in which I think we're very fortunate, though, Mark, because we do have literature, textbooks by solid Catholic scholars and institutions that begin to address these sorts of things. And then we also, as we talked about a minute ago, you brought up, we also have this, you know, 2,000 plus year trajectory of Catholic philosophy and theology, faith and reason, that's going to inform us about how we ought to be approaching these various challenges, benefits, and I would say real potential harms and dangers that come with technology.
Right, and all of this helps to guide us to a better understanding of nature as it is now. True science, to a certain extent, understanding human nature, understanding nature as it naturally comes about, and understanding what the limits are, what the definitions are, what the potentials are, to where we're not putting everything of God's creation at our own service, but we're to a certain extent adding and enhancing in cooperation with our Creator the beauty of nature according to God's design. And that's an interplay of science, it's an interplay of faith, and it's an interplay of, yeah, as you said, that 2,000-year tradition of philosophical thought of what the reality of the universe really is.
And, you know, the interesting thing to me is the fact that with all the science that we have, we've created a paradox when it comes to children. I remember years ago when a couple was going to have a baby, the minute they knew the wife was pregnant, it was automatically, she's going to have a baby, a baby, a baby, baby. That was always the word that was used. No, we didn't have sonograms. We didn't have those types of things. And, you know, there were never these gender reveal parties until the baby was born. And now, here we are, we have technology that can show us this child in the womb. We can get 3D sonograms of this child to the point where I saw one last week where they said, look, this baby even has hair. And yet there are those who will look at that same sonogram and say, oh, it's an embryo. It's not a baby.
It's a choice. It's a choice.
We've come so far and we've lost the awe. It's one of those paradoxes that we'll have to live with technology as we move into the 21st century and beyond.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the great challenges of technology, is how to keep from losing that sense of awe and how to recapture it in the places that we've lost it, and how to come back to a fuller understanding of the gift the creation is, the gift that humanity is, the gift that the universe is, as God created it, and the gift that it could be as it unfolds with our cooperation with the divine will. And so with that thought, I think we're going to leave off until next week. Once again, thank you for listening to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at catholicradioindy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at catholicradioindy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.